Thank you very much. In listening to the discussion, I would pull out sort of three points that I heard. I'll look for sort of nods or shaking ahead to see if you all would concur with these. Three messages I pulled out were these. One is that as much as not the issues of how to make community corrections work are issues of management rather than policy. Right, we have Judge Alm, for instance, did not need state legislation, did not need policymakers at the highest levels to sort of bless what he was doing. He took some leadership. He said he needed some warrants served. He called the, he called the cops, et cetera. Second is that the massive prison expansion that we've seen has been mostly a result of policy choices made at the state and local level rather than due to crime or other sort of broad social economic forces outside the reach of state policymakers. I think West Virginia and Secretary Spears gave us a good example of that and the prison growth that's been seen in West Virginia in the absence of rising crime. And then finally, that when you talk to folks working in the system, they're not talking about this grand debate between treatment and punishment. You know, to a large that you hear so often in inside the Beltway here, and at political levels. I mean, on the ground, that's not the discussion. The discussion is targeting high-risk offenders, and how do we do that? And it seems like it's sort of been exposed at this point as a sort of a false debate. We need treatment and we need punishment. We need to figure out how to stitch the two together. When you use carrots and sticks, you get the best outcomes, and not emphasize one over the other. So I saw a few nods. That may be a reasonable summary. Before we turn to the audience for some questions, I had one as the moderator here, I wanted to throw out to the group, and that is from each of your perspectives. If you had sort of one magic wand, it could be granted one, one wish for how to really improve community corrections, get it to reduce recidivism and hold offenders accountable more to offenders and victims. What would that be? I just sort of offer my first thing, and I'm tempted to go back to the TV show about the probation officers, NYPO or something. But just to offer something different from what each of you might, I would throw out as my one wish that reporters, particularly crime reporters, would call Tom Williams January 2nd when they do the story about why crime in Washington went up or down the previous year. That the press, more generally speaking, would add corrections to the list of folks who are frankly held accountable for what happens in terms of crime. They don't right now. They call the police chief, which is great, and it's appropriate, and it's necessary, but it's certainly not sufficient for the police chief to be the be-all and end-all of the discussion about why crime is rising or falling. It's also a bit unfair to the police. The police should not be held responsible by themselves for that. And I think unless the media, and this is part confession because when I was a crime reporter, I certainly did not call. I didn't know better. I did not call the chief probation officer. I did not call the head of the county treatment system. But when those folks get involved in these conversations, I think we'll see a dramatic improvement in community corrections. Who'd like to go first? Secretary Spears?
Okay, this is on?
Yes, should be.
I think the one wish would be buy-in by the communities themselves that these are the best approaches toward handling a very complex problem. I think right now most people still look at our judicial system as one where they want to punish. And they don't realize that 90%, at least in the state of West Virginia, 90% of those that enter into our prisons are going to one day be released. So these same people that you are fearing because they just committed a crime are in many ways becoming worse criminals, as research has shown, through the time that they've spent incarcerated. So we can actually If we can convince the community that it's in their best interest that we keep them out of prison and that we try and address the issues right there in the community-based programming, I think that it would go a long way. The communities just right now just don't get it. So my one wish would be that they better understand.
That's great. That's great. Judge, one thing you could make happen or one thing you could wish away?
Well, if people were willing to try something different, and we had such a bad problem with methamphetamine that I think people were willing to try something new. I mean, when we have 8,000 people on probation and probably 5,000 have substance abuse issues, we have a drug court for 100 people. We got to take care of the other 4,900 in a way that works. And if people are willing to try something new, how do you set up a system so you can have a hearing 2 business days later? That takes people willing to work a little smarter and harder and faster. But if you start small, and you've got to get the people in a system that can help make that run. And in the court system, the judge is the one who's going to have to get on board to get that done. But by being open to it and trying it and starting small, we can do it. I currently am supervising 600 people in addition to a regular felony caseload on this because they're not contested hearings. They take 10 minutes each. And it can all work that way. When I talked to the jail folks at first, I said if we can keep one person from getting a year, we could send 52 people for a week each. You'd have more processing issues, but as far as bed days, it's the same, but be willing to try something new. So I think that's the hope. If people are willing to be flexible, try something new. If it doesn't work, go on to something else. And we're getting a lot of research. We know more about what works. Let's just do it.
I'm going to say something that's a little bit different. I think people may say, well, as a probation director, he wants more resources. But this may be a little bit of a knock on our academic community, especially our colleges and universities. I really don't think that that group is spending enough time in terms of preparing those folks to come into our agencies to do the work. And what I mean by that, there's a little bit of a theory that's being expounded in the universities. But when they come into us, we have to spend a lot of time to get them prepared to work with these offenders. And so we're seeing a lot of turnover in the field of community corrections. And it takes about 5, 6, maybe 7 years for an officer really to know what they're doing, to move a person from one level of change to another. So we get a lot of, you know, and I talk to a lot of the students that we hire. As a matter of fact, we have an academy class that's going on now, and I got 35 folks in that class because of the turnover that we have. So folks will come to you for about a year or two and figure, this isn't for me. Sometimes within 6 months, it's not for me. So what I would like to see is for the universities and the colleges to really to engage the parole and probation directors in your respective communities and really establish a solid work program for the person to get credit. I'm not talking about the 45-hour business, but they just come in and say, I got, you know, sign this paper so I can get my 45 hours, but at least 6 months to a year commit, and then have them work with us so that we can get these folks prepared so that when they come to a community correction agency and they want to work, they're at least at a different level. I think we're losing a lot of time managing new staff coming in. And when we talk about recidivism, you know, these guys, when they see somebody green come in, they start to salivate right away. And then it's a lot of time that we're spending with the new staff. And unfortunately, supervisors, if they got 8, 10 folks, they know they got a new person, but a lot of times they got to let them go on their own and then catch up with them later. So my challenge, if I had one thing, is for the university presidents, chairs of the department, get in contact with your local parole and probation director and say, what can we do to partner with you to get at least a 6 month or a year work study program? And I'm quite sure 10 to 15% of people who are in criminal justice field right now will probably say, maybe I need to go to a county. And we don't want to, actually, it's a detriment to them, it's a detriment to us, because it's very costly for us as directors to train someone, because it's a lot of outlay that we're putting up front. Only for a year or two, the folks decide, you know, I got to go. And it's good that they made that decision there as opposed to spending, you know, 10 to 15 years with us and then we have to push them out. But that would be my wish.
Thank you. Pam, just before you start, let me just ask folks, welcome to come to the two microphones here and here. Questions, so go ahead.
Is this on? I would advise patients, and the identification of realistic expectations with the understanding that the problem of fixing crime in our community is going to be a complex one. And if you think about, I think about it a lot of times in comparison to how we as a country have gone about cancer research. You know, we don't fund one round of three-year grants and say, which was what the SFORI program was, and say, we're done. You know? And if you look back at the history of federal funding in the correctional area, you see just sort of everything. It just sort of, you do one, a lot of one-shot deals, no sustained effort, no understanding that it's going to take a long time. I mean, you know, we've made tremendous advances in some areas of cancer research in this country, but a lot of times that means that 5% more people are living a couple of 3 or 4 months longer. And I think we need to think about the magnitude of the problem that we have here when we are tackling recidivism and put it into a perspective that says we need to be in this for the long haul. We need to be in this for to understand that this is going to take to get to the 30%, 50% overall. It's going to take years of sustained effort.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, actually, there are three microphones. I'm sure you all over there see that one, but obviously welcome to use that one. I don't see one over here, but it looks like we have three. And Don, why do I have a slight suspicion about what you're going to ask about?
I'm Don Murray. I'm with the National Association of Counties. As all of you know, the corrections system in the United States is an intergovernmental system. It's largely a county and state. So our Justice Committee has come up with our model reform, and I could briefly summarize it. We would appoint in every state a commission or a task force. Many states already have this, but we would refine it in making sure that all the municipalities were represented through their League of Municipalities. All the counties were represented through their State Association of Counties. All the sheriffs were represented through their State Association. So the people on these boards are not just they're not the governor's favorite sheriff. They represent all the sheriffs in the state, all the counties in the state, all the municipalities in the state. And the other half we would leave to the governor and the president of the Senate and the assembly to appoint the others. But then we would bring in a neutral certified mediator, a board certified mediator. Too frequently in states, the state dominates the whole picture. They'll send a white paper to our state association of counties. It might be 100 pages. Our people don't even have time to read the paper. You know, they have all these big staffs at the state level. So the objective, as we see it, is to lower jail populations as well as prison populations. We can do both, as President Obama says. We can do more than one thing. So we think that should be the twin mission.
Thanks. Secretary Spears, you want to address that? You're obviously dealing with, as you described, a very heavy state-local dynamic.
And I was very pleased to hear your comment about wanting to do this in collaboration with the state, because that's exactly what the state is doing in collaboration with our Association of Counties and our Association of County Commissioners and our Sheriff's Bureau and our Association of Sheriffs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We brought those in. If you remember, whenever I said that we formed the, by executive order, this commission to do our study, it had representatives from legislative, judicial, and executive branches, as well as nonprofit organizations, community organizations, and local law enforcement. So it had all of these aspects of it into it to get that same input that you just mentioned. I think we did it right.
Thank you. Over here.
I'm Lou Mayo. I was co-founder of NIJA back in the 60s, of course, long since retired. I have two separate questions. One for the presenter from West Virginia as to what was the primary factor in the rapid escalation of your prisoner population during the 20 years that you referenced. The second is a general question for the panel. To the extent that your programs needed or required cooperation and support from the police, to what extent, if any, did you get that support?
You know, we've tried to look into exactly what was been the cause of this huge rate of increase in our prison growth. And what we've looked at is a combination of factors. One that can't be downplayed is the tougher sanctions and crime sentences that have been imposed by our lawmakers. We went back and looked at over the last, or since the year 2000, there have been 75, in the state of West Virginia, there have been 75 new crimes or increased levels of punishment for existing crimes. 75. Those, on the average, have now increased our population by anywhere from 3 to 10 years. And then when you get the increase in the drug arrests, we've also noted that about 80% of all of our arrests are one way or another related to drugs for those that are serving time in prisons and in jails. Not necessarily on the drug itself charge, but related in some way to drugs. And that increase in the use of drugs and dependency on drugs is having a huge impact on that.
I had great cooperation from the law enforcement, but I think I was the right messenger for it, you know, a Nixon to China kind of thing. If the public defender came up with this, you know, it wouldn't have flown. But because of my background in law enforcement, they knew I wasn't coming up with a new way not to hold people accountable. So they were willing to take a chance. And now that we're getting great results, it reinforces that, you know, they made the right decision and it's worthwhile their time to do it.
Yeah, and similarly with us in terms of strategies for offender supervision. And actually, we are cooperating with law enforcement, particularly at that top end of the tier where those folks who are not drug involved, substance abuse involved, but are really the criminal element per se. So our model of supervision for that group is different. It's more of a surveillance model, and that's how we use the police to help us with that.
I'm Jack Calhoun, formerly Commissioner of Youth Services in Massachusetts. In the mid to late 70s, and as my daughter says, Dad, wasn't that about the time of Bismarck? I'm partially heartened, given my age, by what you're wrestling with, James, in West Virginia, because when I took over, they wanted to reopen the training schools, and we put a commission together of law enforcement and community people. How many should be locked up in X state? But my question is this. Tom, you're wrestling with the idea of NIMBY, and James, you with community is tantamount to being soft on crime. I'm wondering, with all these services done to or done for the offender, whether you've done some thinking about how community corrections can be a resource for that community, as opposed to just acne. How can it be a potential resource? And I don't know where that would take you, whether it's graffiti removal, or restorative justice, or some of these folks speaking in junior high schools about the, I don't know what it is, but I'm talking about a shift to say this is also a community resource. So I'd like your reflections on that.
I didn't mean to cut you off, but we're with you on that. We do a lot in the communities in the District of Columbia, like I mentioned, on a quarterly basis. We're meeting with community organizations. We get calls for special cleanup activities for the community or beautification of areas in the community. So we're right there with them. Our main thrust with the community, though, is on the education piece of, you had a person that's coming back, used to be part of the community. What do we need to do to accept them back? And that's what we actually use in combination to the meetings, our faith-based organizations to assist us with that. We have, in certain pockets of the districts, very difficult time talking with members about people who used to live there and now coming back. They will say to us, first of all, give us the names and the address, and we say, the Privacy Act, we can't do that. Well, now you're not cooperating with you, because basically what they want to do is say, get them out of here. And we're trying to say, you know, we're not going to identify who they are, but at least let's try to embrace them. Now, another section of the community, what we did, we tried this, it was a little bit risky. We got a group of our offenders to come in and then talk to the community. And they had community representatives there. Now, that could get a little dicey, but the way that we try to control that was basically to say, and this came out from the community, you did something against us and our norms. We're going to give you a chance to come back and redeem yourself. But if you don't, then we want to throw you out. And that was a very, like I said, risky thing, was a very powerful thing, and it actually worked for us. But it takes more of a discussion with who this person was, even though he did something against the community norms, to try to now accept him back. But I think that's key to us as we talk about having a sense of community for those persons who are returning and a sense of belonging. If they don't have that, they're going to go right to their crews and their gangs, and that's where they're going to pick it up. And the whole issue of community is not going to be for them.
Yeah. And I was just going to say, the idea of being soft on crime, whenever you equate that with community corrections, again, I pointed out the need to balance punishment and justice. And when you're the victim, you want punishment for that person. Most times, not everybody, but most of them do. Using the case in point, your house is burglarized, nonviolent, but you feel violated because somebody's come into your house. You find out that it's the person that lives right next door to you. I'm using a true case here. Came in, stole your, went through your house on Christmas Day when you were out visiting relatives, stole all your Christmas presents, and then took your car and drove away with all that stuff in your car. Now, nonviolent offense, burglary. He's primed for community corrections. But guess where he goes back to live? He's the teenage son of the family next door. So he lives right next door to you again. Now, you've got to convince the public that that's a good thing. Hello? If you notice in my wish, it was that we could get the community to understand that it's in their best benefit to do this. That's a tough road to hoe. And the only way you can do it is, you can't just go to leaders and say, this is what you've got to do, it's in your best interest. You've got to connect to the people. And if you can't connect to the people and convince them, no success.
Thomas?
Thomas, I'm following with the National Governors Association. My question, and actually the discussion here kind of teased it up, is directed to you, Dr. Lattimore. And I want to make sure I understood what you said. It was almost like it was one of the second to last things you said about the study, the sports study, that you're not finding any difference between return to prison, between the two groups. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And I guess then the larger question is then, how does that not become the story? You know, we're all selling reentry on, you know, the good outcomes, you know, you do better substance abuse, you do better job treatment, you do better, all this kind of good stuff. And these guys are going to go to prison less. And that's kind of the hook to this whole thing. And so I understand how you kind of teamed up talking about that it's more than just a three-year investment. But, you know, when I'm talking to governors and governors' policy advisors about, you know, doing good reentry because it has impacts on your prison rates and you know, this whole question of, you know, whether it's the kid next door, great, you got good outcomes, but he's still going back to jail. He's still costing us $30,000 to $50,000 a year in prison. So the question is there a spin to it? Is there, and what impact might it have on the field in general?
I'm not sure I like the word spin, but I guess that's as good a word as any. I mean, I think that it, when I talked about patience, when I talked about complexity, when I talked about intransigence, when I talked about the depth of need, this is all part of the story. And, you know, it's extraordinarily frustrating for, although I understand that. In fact, in my remarks, which I didn't get to, but I made some comment about, and then when you look at reincarceration, which seems often the only thing that anybody ever cares about. So you have these individuals who have who have substantial deficits, and you don't, you're not willing, there's not a willingness to make an investment, one, to give programs time to develop so that they're actually providing all of the services to the people that are supposed to be getting them. If we had only looked at the reincarceration rate and not done all the data collection we had, we would have concluded exactly what you did. These programs that work. If we had even just only relied on what the program directors told us they were doing in terms of providing services, we would have come to a conclusion that it looks like this really isn't going very far. But when we actually had the opportunity to ask the people who participated, did you get help getting a driver's license? Did you get help finding housing? You know, we found rates sometimes half of what the program directors said they were doing, and even then, you weren't really doing it all. So to us, like I say, a promising beginning means you've started to do something. You started turning this huge ship around, this carrier out in the ocean. You've started turning it around. You started getting all the people on board that can really start to make a difference in the lives of these individuals. And so you've got something to build on. It's not like there's some magic. Actually, when I was at NIJ, I used to talk about aluminum bullets, because they're cheaper than silver and you can recycle them. And there isn't one of those. And I think it's naive to think that there is. That somehow somebody who has no education, no job skills, a criminal history, substance abuse problems, you know, family problems, and probably maybe some mental illness, that somehow you can put them into something for just a short period of time and they're going to be fixed. Because they're people that, you know, they've already flunked out of our school system. They've already been failed a lot of times by social services who let them be abused and neglected when they were children. And so I really understand what you're saying, because I know that's all people care about. Did it make a difference on this final outcome? But I think we're never going to get to a point where we have something that hits the 30%, the 50% that we're talking about, unless we're willing to go in there and say, it's going to take us 10 years, it may take 20 years to pull all the pieces together and effectively do this to start being able to make a difference. And if we don't do that, 10 years, 20 years from now, we're going to be sitting right here with the exact same story that we started something for a year or two and it didn't look like that worked either.
If I could dovetail on that, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I mean, there have been major system failures with the folks that were in charge to supervise. And that was relating to my comments about a better quality of students coming to work with us, because they really have to hit the ground running. With these major systems failures that we have in the community, it's looked upon the criminal justice community of straighten this thing out and get it right the first time.
Right, and now, and I'm not going to give you any money to do it with, but besides that, yeah, everything's cool.
Thank you. I'm sorry, last two questions. We have run out of time. So thank you to the panel. Thank you to NIJ for devoting a plenary to this incredibly important topic. Thank you.